So last week we looked at the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. And this week, the story continues right on from there. John's gospel is unique in this way of telling the story of Palm Sunday and everything that led up to it. His gospel was written much later than the other gospels, so he's far more free to assign blame where it belongs in the whole Easter story, because the powers that be aren't the powers that be anymore when he's writing his. And so the story of Palm Sunday and then Good Friday and Easter Sunday all follow very directly from that raising of Lazarus from the dead. That story was the apex of everything that Jesus had done. He'd been doing extraordinary signs, extraordinary miracles, and then how much more extraordinary can you get than raising somebody from the dead who's been dead for a good 4 days, buried and away in a tomb? And so there were a lot of people there when he did that, and a lot of people believed because they saw that what he had done. Some people, though, and we don't know if they were just sharing the good news or if they weren't sure about things or what motivated them, but some people went to the Pharisees and said to them, "Hey, you know what he's done now? He just raised a guy from the dead." So these people, they tattled. They told the Pharisees what had been going on, which means that the Pharisees have to convene an emergency meeting. They're already not pleased with Jesus. Jesus is already getting the people all excited and all worked up, like maybe he's the guy who's going to overthrow Rome. Well, see, the Jews at the time, they had some good freedom under Rome's rule. Yes, the Roman Empire was in charge. But still, the religious leaders, they had a lot of their own power. They had a lot of freedom to run things in Israel like they wanted to run things. They were still allowed to run things in Jerusalem, in the temple, the way that they always had. Now, there was a lot of abuse and a lot of oppression. For instance, the high priest in Judaism was supposed to serve for 1 year. Every year, there was a different high priest. They had a discernment process. Who was it going to be this year? And so when John says that Caiaphas was the high priest that year, the idea is that was the year he was the high priest. Now, in reality, he'd actually been the high priest for 18 years. And before he stepped up to be the high priest, his father-in-law was the high priest for a good long chunk of time before that. So there was kind of a family dynasty going on that, yep, every year they would have the official, who's going to be the high priest this year? And everybody would say, Caiaphas. Nobody was going to vote against him. He had way too much power. He ran things in Jerusalem. And they liked it that way. But Rome's way of dealing with any nation that they had conquered who started to talk rebellion, who started to talk about wanting to overthrow the empire, was to come in and demolish the people, just destroy it. And certainly about 40 years after Jesus, that's what happened. Rome ended up coming in, wiping out the temple, wiping out Israel pretty much altogether, just saying, enough is enough. But at this time, they still have some power. But they know that there's all of these voices of the people starting to rise up and saying, maybe it's time. Maybe the Roman Empire is going to be defeated. Look what this guy does. He fits all of our Old Testament prophecies. Look what he does. He made a guy who had been blind from birth see again. He took a man who was dead and buried, and he raised him up to life. Surely this is the guy promised by God to rescue us, to save us, to redeem us, to make us great once again. Well, no wonder the leaders all gather together and say, we've got to do something about this guy. Because if the Roman authorities get wind of this, we're done. That's it. We're done. And Caiaphas says, okay, well, let's kill him. He doesn't say it quite that bluntly, but that's essentially what he says. Let's get rid of him. He's the problem. Better that we should, you know, murder one man than that our whole nation would be destroyed. Let's just do it. And that's the beginning of the end for Jesus. That's when they put essentially a bounty on Jesus' head. Whoever turns in this guy, tells us where we can find him, you're going to get some money. And we know how that goes with Judas down the road. So Jesus went into hiding. Jesus and his disciples went off into the wilderness. They went into a little town called Ephraim, off in the wilderness where no one would think to look for them. And they stayed there for a while, knowing that it was not safe for Jesus. And then Jesus says, you know what? I'm sick of the wilderness. Let's go to Bethany, 2 miles from Jerusalem. And let's have dinner with Mary and Martha and Lazarus, because they're my good friends. So we're going to go have dinner. Yeah, I know there's a bounty on my head. I know Bethany is full of people who will turn me into the Pharisees. But you know what? Let's go anyways. Do you ever wonder what on earth was going on in Jesus' head? I mean, we can really spiritualize it and say he knew that this was the time for the crucifixion, the death. This was the time for everything that God had planned for him. And maybe that is the case. But Jesus was not just a divine God-man. He was a man. He was this human person who knew that his life was at stake. And yet he chose to go ahead anyways. That's an extraordinary thing to me. He chose not just to go to Bethany, but eventually he chose to go right into the heart of the mouth of the beast. He chose to go right into the heart of Israel, into Jerusalem itself, on the high holy day of the year, on Passover. That is a guy who's committed to what God has laid before him, who's saying, this is not going to end well. Jesus was not an idiot. He knew that this was not going to end well, but he went anyways. Isn't that an extraordinary thing, that he went anyways? Why? Because he had a death wish? I don't think so. All accounts of Jesus show that he loved life. He loved people. I mean, he raised somebody from death. That in itself says that he loved life more than death. So why would he do that? Why would he put himself so obviously in harm's way when he didn't have to? Surely if he had stayed in hiding for a while, the hubbub would have died down and he could have gone about his life teaching more. Wouldn't it be nice if we had more than 3 years of Jesus teaching? Surely there could have been another way. I don't know, if I was in Jesus' shoes, I could have rationalized a lot of ways to not go where God was leading and go different ways, and it would have all sounded really good. And I know that you are as equally capable as I am in making our own decisions sound just as good as God's decisions. But Jesus went anyway, and he went and had dinner. Sounds like nothing. He went to his friend's house for dinner. And the people get wind of this. They get wind that Jesus is there. And so a bunch of people say, oh, we're going to go. We know where he is. We're going to go and see him and hear him. And he's at Lazarus's. Have you heard? Lazarus was dead and now he's not. We want to go get a look at that. That's something. I wonder what he looks like. Do you think he looks like a zombie? Do you think he's still got some cloth wrapped around him? Do you think he's like can talk still or makes weird grunting noises like zombies do? You know, you wonder what people were thinking, but they all wanted to go and see the spectacle of it all. And they converge on Lazarus's house. And they are excited. They are so pumped up because they know, whether they could put words to it or not, they know that there's something about Jesus that they have been waiting for generations. And they go. Now, what's interesting is that we learned earlier in John that anybody who was having anything to do with Jesus also had their lives at risk. That you couldn't go around saying, oh, have you heard what Jesus did? He's this amazing thing. I think he's the Messiah. I think he's the one that God promised. You couldn't do that, especially that close to Jerusalem, because your own life was in danger. You know, it's not just the question of what could have motivated Jesus to go out of hiding and walk toward the cross. But what motivated the crowds of people to put their lives at risk, to go see Jesus, to go be with him? They're the ones who accompanied him when he went from Bethany, which was, again, just kind of up a hill and over a ways. He was there for dinner, and the crowds accompanied him down the hill, which was a historic, amazing hill. It was always said that the king would come riding, they expected, on a stallion, a war horse, down this road, down the Mount of Olives, into this specific gate into Jerusalem. They were waiting for that, and they guided Jesus down there. Dinner was over and they said, let's go. And they've got branches that they grab up, palm branches, and they're waving them in the air, and they're taking off their coats, and they're making like this red carpet so that the celebrity Jesus could walk into Jerusalem as the celebrity that he was. They're surrounding. Don't they know that their lives are at risk for doing that? I wonder where the disciples were in all of this. They're in the pictures, in the artwork that we have of Palm Sunday, but there's nothing mentioned of them in the story at all. I wonder where Peter was in all of this. I wonder who was in the crowd. I wonder if Zacchaeus was there. I wonder if he was one of the people waving a palm branch. I wonder if Nicodemus was there, probably all sedate and walking a little bit more calmly. I wonder if there were any Samaritans there. Any of the people from the village where the Samaritan woman had met Jesus at the well, were they there? Had they gone seeking Jesus? Were they waving palm branches? I wonder if the blind man was there. Probably overwhelmed by all the noise and crowd when you've been blind from birth and you can suddenly see. But I wonder if he was in that crowd. I wonder where the disciples were. I wonder if they were walking right with him going, yeah, this is Jesus, this is our king, we saw it from day one, we're right with him. Or I wonder if one or two of them were maybe hanging back a bit going, this is not a good idea. I wonder where Peter was. We know, we look ahead and we know that on Good Friday, when Jesus is arrested and when he's on trial, Peter's off hiding, denying Jesus. And I wonder where he was in this crowd. I wonder if he kind of melted back into the crowd or if he was still brave enough at that point to be seen with all of the people. There's so much that we never get told in these stories. I would like to be able to time travel back and ask John, okay, tell me about this. Tell me what motivated this person. Tell me who was there. What was going on here and here and here? But we don't know that. Because for John, those things weren't what was most important. For John and for the other gospel writers, the thing that was most important was that Jesus went into Jerusalem in the mode of the promised king who'd been promised for hundreds of years that he was coming. That Jesus went not like the king they expected, riding a great war horse with his sword above his head, ready to overthrow the Romans, but he went into Jerusalem on the colt of a donkey with the rabble cheering him on. These weren't the high and mighty people in the crowds. He wasn't getting honored by the greats. These were the peasants. These were the people who were nobody. These were the women and the children and the diseased and the broken people. My goodness, if you step foot in that crowd, you were bound to become unclean in a matter of seconds because they were touching you all over the place. People who weren't religiously and ritually pure and holy. Because those are the people that were drawn to Jesus. Because those are the people that Jesus looked at and said, it's worth my life if they can have hope. It's worth everything if they can be reconciled to God. That's what was going on with Jesus, I think. He's looking at these people, and we're in our society, it's harder to see and imagine that. Because in our society, the church is pretty much a solidly middle class affair. We don't know for the most part what it is to be cast out of society, to be shunned, to be oppressed, to be treated unjustly at every turn, and to get to the point where we just assume that's all we're worth. Where we just expect to be given the runaround. Where we expect that whenever somebody speaks to us, they're going to assume we're trying to put one over on them. Or we're lying to them. Or we're just not good enough. Now, I know some in this room have had that experience, but for the most part, it's hard for us to imagine and to put ourselves in the shoes of the people who were in that crowd. These were people who people didn't talk to. Who were nobody. They didn't get to go to school. They didn't get to have certainly like post-secondary educations, which is kind of the norm in our lives. They didn't have houses and jobs necessarily. They didn't have free time. They didn't have days off. You know, in the earliest churches, they always met like before the sun came up. They would gather in a house before the sun came up. Why? Why not just go to church like regular people at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning? Because they were working. They were working 7 days a week. That's the kind of people that were in this crowd. That's the kind of people that from the very beginning of Jesus' ministry right through to the end, that he had a special spot in his heart for. People who knew what it was to be nothing and nobody. And Jesus thought they were somebody enough that he went out of hiding into the belly of the beast, right into the heart of Jerusalem, even though he knew, he had to know, that the end was going to be horrible and gruesome and painful and absolute. He went because he loved them that much that he couldn't just go off into hiding. And they, in turn, loved him so much that they congregated at Mary and Martha and Lazarus's house. And they accompanied him into the place where many of them were often shunned and not even allowed to set foot very close to. They put their lives at risk as well. Why would they do that? As I was thinking about this story, I was wondering how many of us would put our lives at risk for Jesus. I was wondering if there was a bounty on the heads of anybody who was caught proclaiming that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, that he is the Christ, that he is King of Kings, Son of God, any of these things, any of these titles that we Christians attribute to Jesus, if there was a bounty put on your head if you said those words, if you were outside and you happened to say, I don't know what you say in your backyards, thank you God for Jesus, or Jesus Christ is King, or Hosanna, or I don't know what you would say in your backyard, but if you said one of those things and your neighbor heard, and they could call the police and they would come arrest you and put you to death, I mean, that's very foreign in Canada, that doesn't really happen ever, but try and imagine for a moment that just simply uttering a profession of faith about Jesus was going to cost you your life. Is it worth it? Uttering professions about Christ in our society, in our culture, really doesn't cost us much. Sometimes the odd look maybe from a coworker or people who just tell you to shut up about all your Christian stuff. But for the most part, it doesn't really cost us. Not like it costs those people. Now you might say, well, those people had nothing to begin with, so what else was there for them to lose? And there's some truth in that. When you have nothing to lose, it's easier to put it all on the line. But I do wonder. I wonder if we would be in that crowd, knowing, I mean, not just as curious onlookers going, wow, I want to see this guy who raised somebody from the dead, or I want to see this guy who was dead and now he's not. I want to know what he looks like. Beyond that, I wonder if we would be in that crowd. I wonder if we would be lining the streets, not just standing back to say, I wonder what's happening here, but physically picking up branches, waving, shouting words of worship worthy of a king, throwing our own coats down so that anybody who looked could say, that's a person who believes. Not, oh, they're just a curious onlooker standing at the back, kind of hiding a little bit. No, that's a person who believes. Would we be that person in that crowd? And I think it depends on whether or not Jesus has affected our lives as much as he affected the lives of the people who were in that crowd. I wonder if we have stories like Zacchaeus or Nicodemus or the Samaritan woman or the blind man or even Lazarus. I wonder if we have stories that powerful that mean we would congregate. We would be public about our faith and our love for Jesus Christ, even at the cost potentially of our own freedom and our own lives. Because I think if we're just Christians because it's the thing you do, Or because we're a little concerned that maybe when we die, if we're not a Christian, it might not go so good for us. So we do it kind of as a little bit of insurance. I don't think that's enough. I don't think that's enough to be in a crowd that could get you killed. But when he has changed your life completely. A few weeks ago, I asked you to spend a week, and I don't know if any of you did, but to spend a week and imagine what your life would be like without Jesus Christ in it. Some of you have had Jesus in your life your whole lives. You don't know, so use your imagination. What would your life be like if he wasn't Lord of your life? If he hadn't taken that walk from Bethany into Jerusalem, and then from Jerusalem to Golgotha where he was crucified? What would your life be like? Would it be any different? Because if it wouldn't be any different, then you probably wouldn't be in the crowd. But if your life is different because of Jesus Christ in it, then you probably also would be in the crowd. Because it wasn't just Jesus who risked his life by coming out of hiding. So did the people. And Jesus came out of hiding because he loved those people so much. He had to take the next step. He had to go the next place. The world has changed because Jesus went out of hiding and had dinner in Bethany. If he hadn't done that, I can't even imagine what our world would be like. But because Jesus did that, our entire world is different. Those of you who've been coming Monday nights and studying Christian history for the last 7 weeks, you know that. We've been learning all about the first 300 years of Christianity and how it dramatically altered the world. But Jesus didn't do it because he wanted to make a political statement. He did it because he loved those people so much that he had to. Because he loved us so much that he had to. And so the question that we're left with is, do we love him enough to be part of that crowd, to risk everything?